Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Matters, the show in which I discuss all matters of the mind and in which I show how much mind matters. A very warm welcome to part 25 of Control Your Brain, Control Your Life. I am Udo Staatsbucher and I'm live on air, and I welcome your calls with questions and comments as long as they relate to the subject I'm talking about. All other questions, comments, and suggestions I will answer by email. I welcome your communication with me enormously because it is important for me to learn what you think about this series, and I also value your comments and suggestions. So keep on sending them. For newcomers, just go to my website http://www.mindmattersonline.info. Mind Matters Online is one word. There you will find my email address, and then write to me. I will reply within 48 hours. On page 3 of the website, the following pages, you will find recording all my previous radio programs for you to listen to at your convenience. Last week, we had the third and last part of my discussion on cancer. I had mentioned that I have cancer and that this week I was going to have another MRI scan to determine if or if not the cancer has progressed. I also told you that I would let you know of the outcome. Here's the good news that the cancer has progressed, albeit only ever so slightly. I will therefore continue doing what I have been doing since cancer had been diagnosed. I continue being positive and upbeat about it. I continue enjoying my life to the fullest. I continue exercising daily for 1.5 hours. And I will continue having a very sensible diet. And now let us move on. Today I'm going to speak about something totally different: the mysterious power of love. In the process, I will demystify some of this mysterious power, and unfortunately, I will disappoint some of you in the process. On the other hand, you will learn to use much of it for your own benefit. Sex and love are the great driving forces of human affairs, the source of our deepest feelings and the inspiration for much of our culture. Yet, how much do we really understand them? Attraction. The very word attracts. And why should it not? Attraction is incredibly attractive, especially when it is powerful and mutual. Attraction can provide a link to another human so irresistible that it feels like being bewitched, that makes all other needs and duties meaningless, tiresome, and irrelevant. Away from our object of desire, we are distracted, unable to eat, unable to sleep, unable to concentrate. All that matters is the next encounter, because only then we feel euphoric, blissful, full of life, and full with tenderness. With that other person, we feel that nothing is missing anymore. Couples that are so drawn together talk of being two halves, complete only when they are together. Who would refuse such luxury, such security, and such communion? Who would not want to be so lucky? Anyway, isn't that passionate compulsion practically useful? Doesn't it encourage exclusive pair bonding in humans and foster the lovely notion that there is a perfect soulmate somewhere in the world for everyone? Or is that feeling so outrageously wonderful that there has to be a catch somewhere? Attraction, after all, can be so overwhelming of the individuals and of the individual's other necessary duties in relationships that during most of Western history, it has been also considered dangerous and destabilizing as well as celebrated. The ancient Greeks portrayed sexual attraction as a weapon, a dart that might pierce the flesh and that might possess a soul, causing chaos among humans and gods alike. Now, in its general thrust, our culture is in love with the idea of love, awash with romance, and we are often unable to tell anymore what is attraction, what lust is, and what love is. Puberty and even childhood is suffused with a popular music soundtrack that peddles endless banal songs to the importance of romance. Most people want schmaltzy anthems at their wedding, celebrating some songwriter's long since ruined true love. At some point, most teenage girls at least play with the idea of giving attraction a dry run by developing a crush on a pop star or movie star. On the whole, people don't really like it when scientists tell them that attraction is all down to pheromones or waist to hip proportion or instinctive recognition of genetic differentiation. There is disappointment as well when so-called relationship experts tell us that togetherness is tough work, involving ceaseless selflessness and commitment to the needs of others. It is love we want, because we want to believe that love conquers all. It is considered the wonder of attraction when a couple recognizes a special bond from the first glance. Their eyes met across a crowded room. They fell in love at first sight. They knew they had found their soulmate, and so on and so on. But really, it is not in the least surprising that many couples lay claim to such a moment of revelation, and I'll tell you why. The great thing about love at first sight is that it is retrospective. The exchange of a special look can be forgotten within moments if a seemingly perfect potential partner is exposed within a minute of conversation as boring or vulgar or has bad breath. But if the exchange of looks that register mutual interest is followed up by the discovery of easy conversation, shared humor, fascinating opinions, common enthusiasm, and a yearning to touch and be touched, then the first glance is remembered and treasured forever. Even if the encounter goes nowhere, even if one of the amazing things that the two discover have in common is a spouse at home looking after the children whilst they are out and having fun, then that short time of togetherness can still be filed away as a beguiling monument to what might have been. And if the encounter does develop, and if the sexual pairing is as intimate and intense as it promised to be, if care, commitment, and domestic compatibility lead to the creation of one big happy family, then that first meeting becomes a talismanic opening to a family's tale of perfect togetherness. But social science does, in its controlled experiments and clinical assessments, offer an alternative story of love. And this story is, humans, like all other animals, tend at times to be in search of a mate. At such times, each encounter with anyone who might possibly consider a candidate is an audition. Without even being particularly aware of it, people tend to size up potential partners and even just potential friends all the time. Research has shown that people make complex judgments about others based on age, physical appearance, sartorial presentation, deportment, demeanor, and social context in a matter of seconds after seeing or meeting them. Our own observation of the world around us confirms that such a triage can be ruthless. People who are physically beautiful tend immediately to dismiss those they consider less beautiful than they are. People who reckon themselves stylish are repelled by those who are not. People who set store by their social standing will at one glance decide whether a person is likely to be as privileged as them and reject those who do not measure up. When we are looking for a partner, we are auditing all the time. Once a target is so selected, the chances are that further investigation will indeed elicit mutual interest. People tend to be attracted by people who find them or seem likely to find them attractive. The faces we like best are the faces that are looking our way. The eyes that we are mesmerized by are the eyes that are looking into ours. The banal truth around the world is that couples tend to be homogeneous. They choose people who are at a similar level of attractiveness or intelligence or background or economic power. When people step outside that convention, others are often distrustful of the couple in question and their motives. A beautiful young woman, for example, may decide that she is not going to barter her beauty and youth in the sexual marketplace in order to snare someone who is as young and as beautiful as she is. She may decide instead that she will cash in for old and rich. This is a fair exchange between consenting adults, but one that is often seen as pretty laughable or is even scorned or rejected by others. We may be fascinated when people make truly surprising and or weird love matches, like the upper-class English woman who marries into a traditional East African tribe and lives happily ever after. But mostly we are fairly disapproving when people break the unwritten rules of the mating game and use the advantage of their sexual attractiveness or their money and power to attract someone who is out of their league. So, can the mundane truth be that those amazing actions of perfect love occur when a person instantly identifies a potential partner? Can this be nothing more or less than a flattering reflection of themselves? Can overwhelming attraction, whether or not it develops into anything long-lasting, actually be at root narcissistic? Anecdotal reference to that heady feeling of novel attraction will confirm that along with the weak knees, fluttery tummies is the bolstering of one's own ego. Part of the joy of having that other person so intimately present in one's life is firmly connected to the undeniable fact that they also make you feel just great about yourself. Sigmund Freud placed the ability to form meaningful relationships with the opposite sex as a result of good parenting, and the inability to do so as a consequence of dysfunctional relationships between girls and their fathers or boys and their mothers. He also suggested that while a degree of narcissism was present in all humans, it was important to release self-love by giving love to another person, or else narcissism would grow unchecked and become destructive. Carl Jung went further and suggested what seemed like love at first sight was merely projection. People see their masculine animus or the feminine anima in a member of the opposite sex and are attracted by what they recognize as the unconscious and hidden part of themselves. This means, in other words, that men unconsciously recognize their own femininity and women their own masculinity in an encounter with a member of the opposite sex. For Jung, it was important to understand that aspect of one's psyche so that one could stop projecting, grow up and learn to engage with one's own anima or animus, so that one could choose wisely and start forming informed relationships. Inability to do so was for Jung the reason why people sometimes found themselves trapped in a romantic Groundhog Day, choosing again and again similarly unsuitable or abusive partners and falling into unreasonable obsessions ending in hurt and tears. Again, such an analysis is not always entirely welcome. It does indeed seem like rather a con that the idea that the unlucky in love ought to sign up with a Jungian analyst and work on getting to know and understand the hidden sexual archetype. Yet, like many of Jung's ideas and many of Freud's, it is hard to dismiss them completely. In the end, we could conclude that whatever we might tell ourselves about love at first sight and irresistible passion, in reality, we fancy the people that our genes and our upbringing tell us to fancy. Now, where's the romance in that? Let us have a look at the types and stages of love, of which there are three distinct ones. The first stage is lust or erotic passion. Then comes attraction or romantic passion. And finally, attachment or commitment. When all the three of these happens with the same person, it's perfect. You have a very strong bond. Sometimes, however, the one we lust after is not the one we are actually in love with. When we are teenagers, just after puberty, estrogen and testosterone become active in our bodies for the first time, and they create the desire in us to experience love. These desires, also known as lust, play a big role both during puberty and throughout our lives. Lust and romantic love are two different things with different underlying causes. Lust evolved for the purpose of sexual mating, while romantic love evolved because of the need for infant or child bonding. So even though we often experience lust for our romantic partner, sometimes we don't. And that's okay. Or maybe we do, but we also lust after someone else. Pheromones, which are a chemical factor involved in the pre-mating process, looks and our own predisposition for what we look in a mate play an important role in whom we lust after. Without lust, we might never find that special someone. But while lust keeps us looking around, it is our desire for romance that leads us to attraction. While the initial feelings may or may not come from lust, whatever happens next, if the relationship is to progress, is attraction. When attraction or romantic passion comes into play, we often lose our ability to think rationally, at least when it comes to the object of our attraction. The old saying, love is blind, is really accurate in this stage. We are often oblivious to any flaws our partner might have. We idealize them and can't get them off our minds. This overwhelming preoccupation and drive is part of our biology. In this stage, couples spend many hours getting to know each other. If this attraction remains strong and is felt by both of them, then they usually enter the third stage, attachment. Romantic love both exhilarates and motivates us. It is also critical to the continuation of our species. Without the attachment of romantic love, we would live in an entirely different society that more closely resembles some of those social circles in the animal world. The chemicals that race around in our brain when we are in love serve several purposes, and the primary goal is the continuation of our species. Those chemicals are what make us want to form families and have children. Once we have children, those chemicals change to encourage us to stay together and to raise those children. So in reality, love really is a chemical addiction that occurs to keep us reproducing. Regardless of the country or culture, romantic love plays an important part. While cultural differences vary greatly in how that love is displayed, the fact that romantic love exists is undisputed. But let's get down to the nitty-gritty. What is it that makes us fall in love with someone in the first place? We all have a template for the ideal partner buried somewhere deep in our subconsciousness. Some developmental psychologists suggest that girls at the age of 7 or 8 years old, in other words, prepubescent, have already a well-formed picture in their minds how their future mates should be. Very often this picture is a likeness of their fathers or other male role models. It is this love map that decides which person in the crowded room catches our eye. This template is formed by appearance, by personality, and by pheromones. Now, as I already said, many researchers have speculated that we tend to go for members of the opposite sex who reminds us of our parents. On the other hand, some have even found that we tend to be attracted to those whose looks remind us of ourselves. Very similar with appearance, we tend to form preferences for those who remind us of our parents or other role models in our childhood and sometimes even later because of their personality, their wisdom, their sense of humor, likes and dislikes, and others. And then there are pheromones. The word pheromone comes from the Greek words pherein and hormone, meaning excitement carrier. In the animal world, pheromones are individual scent prints found in urine or sweat that dictate sexual behavior and attract the opposite sex. They help animals identify each other and choose a mate with an immune system different enough from their own to ensure healthy offspring. The existence of human pheromones was discovered only in 1986 by scientists at the Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia and its counterpart in France. They found these chemicals in human sweat. There is evidence that smell is an important aspect of love. That's why we use perfumes and aftershaves. An experiment was conducted where a group of females smelled the unwashed t-shirts of a group of sweaty males, and each had to select the one to whom she was most attracted. Just like in the animal world, the majority of the females chose a shirt from the male whose immune system was the most different from their own. The attachment or commitment stage is love for the duration. You have now passed fantasy love and are entering into real love. This stage of love has to be strong enough to withstand many problems and distraction. The more we idealize the one we love, the stronger the relationship during the attachment stage. This idealization keeps people together and makes a happier marriage. Playing a key role in this stage are oxytocin, vasopressin, and endorphins, which are released when having sex. Let us find out more about the chemistry of love, but first I have to have a sip of water because my throat is getting dry. I'm back again. There are a lot of chemicals racing around your brain and body when you are in love. Researchers are gradually learning more and more about the roles that play both when we are falling in love and when we are in a long-term relationship. Of course, estrogen and testosterone play a role in the sex drive area. Without them, we might never venture into the real love arena. The initial giddiness that comes when we are first falling in love includes a racing heart, flushed skin and sweaty palms. Researchers say this is due to the dopamine and norepinephrine we are releasing. Dopamine is thought to be the pleasure chemicals producing a feeling of bliss. Norepinephrine is similar to adrenaline and produces the racing heart and the excitement. Together, these two chemicals produce elation, intense energy, sleeplessness, craving, loss of appetite, and focused attention. The human body releases the cocktail of love rapture only when certain conditions are met, and men more readily produce it than women because of our more visual nature. Researchers are using fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, to watch people's brains when they look at a photograph of their object of affection. What they see in those scans during that crazed, can't think of anything else stage of romance, the attraction stage, is a biological drive to focus on one person. The scans showed increased blood flow in areas of the brain with high concentrations of receptors for dopamine, which are associated with states of euphoria, craving, and addiction. High levels of dopamine are also associated with norepinephrine, which heightens attention, short-term memory, hyperactivity, sleeplessness, and goal-oriented behavior. In other words, couples in this stage of love focus intently on the relationship and often on very little else. Research has also discovered that people in love have lower levels of serotonin and also that neural circuits associated with the way we assess others are suppressed. These lower serotonin levels are the same as those found in people with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, possibly explaining why those in love obsess about their partner. In romantic love, when two people have sex, oxytocin is released, which helps bond the relationship. The hormone oxytocin has been shown to be associated with the ability to maintain healthy interpersonal relationships and healthy psychological boundaries with other people. When it is released during orgasm, it begins creating an emotional bond. Therefore, the more sex, the greater the bond. Vasopressin, an antidiuretic hormone, is another chemical that has been associated with the formation of long-term monogamous relationships. It is assumed that oxytocin and vasopressin interfere with the dopamine and norepinephrine pathways, which might explain that passionate love fades as attachment grows. Endorphins, the body's natural painkillers, also play a key role in long-term relationships. They produce a general sense of well-being, including feeling soothed, reassured, peaceful, and secure. Like dopamine and norepinephrine, endorphins are released during sex. They are also released during physical contact, exercise, and other activities. As people know who are addicted to their daily exercises, endorphins can induce a drug-like dependency. What about when the euphoric feeling is gone? The speed at which courtship progresses often determines the ultimate success of the relationship. Research shows that the longer the courtship, the stronger the long-term relationship. The feelings of passionate love, however, do lose their strength over time. Studies have shown that passionate love fades quickly and is nearly gone after 2 or 3 years. The chemicals responsible for that loving feeling, adrenaline, dopamine, norepinephrine, etc., dwindle. Suddenly, your lover has faults. Why he or she has changed, you may wonder. Actually, your partner probably has not changed at all. It is just that you are now able to see him or her rationally, rather than through the blinding hormones of infatuation and passionate love. At this stage, the relationship is either strong enough to endure, or the relationship ends. If the relationship can advance, then other chemicals kick in. Endorphins, for example, are still providing a sense of well-being and security. Additionally, oxytocin is still released when you are having sex, and it produces feelings of satisfaction and attachment. Vasopressin, remember that is the one that is associated with long-term monogamous relationship, of course, also continues to play a big role in attachment. All this, of course, sounds very analytical, and some of you may even say that it sounds cynical, but it is not. Love is as critical for your mind and body as oxygen. This is not negotiable. The more connected you are, the healthier you will be, both emotionally as well as physically. The less connected you are, the more you are at risk. It is also true that the less love you have, the more depression you are likely to experience in your life. Love is probably the best antidepressant there is, because one of the most common sources of depression is feeling unloved. Most depressed people do not love themselves, and they do not feel loved by others. They also are very self-focused, making them less attractive to others and depriving them of the opportunities to learn the skills of love. There is a belief in our culture that love just happens. As a result, the depressed often sit around passively waiting for someone to love them. But love doesn't work that way. To get love and keep love, you have to go out and be active and learn a variety of specific skills. Most of us get our ideas of love from popular culture. We come to believe that love is something that sweeps us off our feet. But the pop culture ideal of love consists of unrealistic images created for entertainment, which is one reason so many of us are set up to be depressed. It is part of our national vulnerability, like eating junk food, constantly stimulated by images of instant gratification. We think it is love when it is simply distraction and infatuation. One consequence is that when we hit real love, we become upset and disappointed because there are many things that do not fit our cultural ideal. Some of us get demanding and controlling, wanting someone else to do what we think of our ideal romance should be, without realizing that our ideal is misplaced. It is not only possible but necessary to change one's approach to love to ward off depression. Follow the following strategies to get more of what you want out of life, to love and be loved. Recognize the difference between limerence and love. Limerence is a psychological state of deep infatuation. It feels good, but rarely lasts. Limerence is that first stage of mad attraction whereby all the hormones are flowing and things feel so right. Limerence lasts, however, on average, just 6 months. It can progress to love, and love mostly starts out as limerence, but limerence does not always evolve into love. Know that love is a learned skill, not something that comes from hormones or emotions particularly. It is rather an act of will. If you do not learn the skills of love, you virtually guarantee that you will be depressed, not only because you will not be connected enough, but because you will have many failure experiences. Learn good communication skills. They are a means by which you develop trust and intensify connection. The more you can communicate, the less depressed you will be, because you will feel known and understood. There are always core differences between two people, no matter how good or close you are. And if the relationship is going right, so those differences surface. The issue then is to identify the differences and negotiate them so that they don't distance you or kill the relationship. You do that by understanding where the other person is coming from, who that person is, and by being able to represent also yourself. When the differences are known, you must be able to negotiate and compromise on them until you find a common ground that works for both. Focus on the other person rather than focus on what you are getting and how you are being treated. Read your partner's needs. What does this person really need for his or her own well-being? This is a very tough skill for people to learn in our narcissistic culture. Of course, you don't lose yourself in the process. You make sure you are also doing enough self-care. Help someone else. Depression keeps people so focused on themselves, they don't get outside themselves enough to be able to learn to love. The more you can focus on others and learn to respond and meet their needs, the better you're going to do in love. Develop the ability to accommodate simultaneous reality. The loved one's reality is as important as your own, and you need to be aware of it as of your own. What are they really saying? What are they really needing? Depressed people think the only reality is their own depressed reality. Actively dispute your internal messages of inadequacy. Sensitivity to rejection is a cardinal feature of depression. As a consequence of low self-esteem, every relationship blip is interpreted far too personally as an evidence of inadequacy. Quick to feel rejected by a partner, you then believe it is a treatment that you do fundamentally deserve. But the rejection really originates in you, and the feelings of inadequacy are the depression speaking. Recognize that the internal voice is strong, but it's not real. Talk back to it. I'm not really being rejected. This isn't really evidence of inadequacy. I only made a mistake. Or, this isn't about me. This is something I just didn't know how to do well, and now I will learn. When you reframe the situation to something more adequate, you can act again in an effective way, and you can find and keep the love that you need. We have heard many wonderful tales about love at first sight. Many books and movies idealize this phenomenon, and many people report it as the most intense emotion. Some people even consider love at first sight to be the only kind of genuine love. Love at first sight is not easy to explain. If romantic love consists of evaluating the other person as attractive and as having positive characteristics, then how can we possibly make an evaluation of the characteristics at first sight? Some of these characteristics, such as kindness and honesty, cannot be revealed in one glance. Knowledge of these characteristics requires familiarity and a shared history, which are clearly absent at first sight. It is easier to speak about sexual desire at first sight, since such a desire is based upon the attractiveness of the other person, something that can be perceived at first sight. Although people often confuse love at first sight with sexual desire at first sight, there are nevertheless genuine cases of love at first sight, as many people have reported. The fundamental mistake in denying the existence of love at first sight is the assumption that we cannot attribute to a person, that a characteristic that is not present at first sight. Such attribution is done spontaneously by using certain stereotypical evaluations. To activate a schema of an ideal person, not all aspects the ideal have to be present. Sometimes items of seemingly no significance, such as a business suit, a doctor's uniform, a certain smile, or a particular voice, may activate one's schema of an ideal person. These considerations are consistent with the attractiveness halo, in which a person who is perceived as beautiful is assumed to have other positive characteristics as well. Accordingly, attractive people who are evaluated mainly on the basis of their appearance are more likely to be the object of love at first sight. In light of its stereotypical nature, love at first sight can often mislead the participants as it is based more on imagination than on sight. Can we speak about love at first kilobyte? In online relationships, the weight of the other person's attraction is considerably smaller. Getting to know each other is more crucial. As the information in the first message is quite limited, cases of love at first kilobyte are extremely rare. But it can happen. The receiver of an email can marvel about the writer's romanticism, their wit, or whatever else they find attractive. And from there they paint a picture of the writer and add more characteristics that they want to see in that writer. More common cases are those of love at first online chat, as such a chat provides a bit more information. For example, one may detect in the first chat also a sense of humor and wittiness, and also the sound of the speaker's voice or the laughter, and instantly fall in love with the speaker. This is linked with a personality halo, in which a person who is perceived as having a certain positive personality trait is assumed to have other positive characteristics as well. It should be noted that although beauty has a powerful impact at first sight, the weight of this impact decreases as time goes by and once we know other characteristics of the person. Likewise, wittiness has a powerful impact at first chat, but its impact may be reduced once we know other characteristics of the person. When wittiness is perceived to be superficial and more profound characteristics such as kindness and wisdom are found to be wanting, the weight of the positive initial impact of the wittiness surely will vanish. In love at first sight, the high value accorded to the other's external appearance is projected onto her characteristics. In love at first chat, the high value accorded to the other's writing abilities is projected onto other characteristics, including external. Both are instances of real love that is based on scant information and on imagination that fills the missing gap. Love at first sight can be the basis for profound long-term love, provided that the characteristics typically revealed in verbal communication later enhance the characteristics that are revealed at first sight. Similarly, that can be basis for profound long-term love, provided that the characteristics typically revealed to sight later enhance the characteristics revealed at first chat. The fact that such types of love may perish does not mean that they were not instances of true love. Time is not an exclusive measure for true love. I have come to the end of this show. As usual, I would love to hear comments and suggestions about this show and the others before it. I will answer all your questions you have, and if you have any problems you want to talk to me about, I'm happy to give you my best possible advice. Just go to my website, mindmattersonline.info, and write to me. Mind Matters Online, is one word. Hearing from you. For now I leave you with words by Miles Davis, and I quote, "If you love them in the morning, with the eyes full of crust, if you love them at night, with the hair full of rollers, chances are that you are in love." Unquote. Tune in again next week, same day, same time. Goodbye.